Australia in the World is a podcast produced with the support of the Australian Institute of International Affairs. The AAA wants Australians to know, understand and engage more in international affairs. All views expressed are solely those of the speakers themselves. Hello and welcome back to the Australia in the World podcast. I'm Darren Lim from the ANU. As regular listeners will know, a few recent episodes have formed part of a mini-series on international order. I discussed war and international order with Andrew Phillips, and the most recent episode was on the international economic order with Jenny Gordon. This episode continues that series, and the theme is China. It's cliche by this point to say that China is having a major impact on the current order and its trajectory. But I can tell you that there is absolutely no agreement among scholars, or policymakers and commentators for that matter, on what that impact is and how far it might go. I've taken a keen interest in this question in my research, co-authoring a paper titled China and the Logic of Illiberal Hegemony with John Eikenberry that came out last year in the academic journal Security Studies. The journal's editors subsequently invited two scholars to write critiques of our argument. One of those is a friend and colleague of mine at the ANU, Amy King, and she joins me on today's episode to discuss this issue, using my paper and her critique to anchor our conversation. Amy is an associate professor in the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at the ANU and deputy director research at the ANU's Bell School. She is an international relations scholar with a focus on East Asia, having undertaken intensive language study and fieldwork in China, Japan, and Taiwan over the past 15 years, and having won numerous grants and awards for her work. This is another long and wide-ranging conversation that is, again, a bit more academic than normal for the podcast. But, as you'll hear right from the outset, we're very much focused as well on what order means in concrete and practical terms. When an Australian diplomat tells a counterpart in the region that they should care about the international order, what exactly does that mean? It's very easy, I think, to project one's own opinions and priors onto a discussion of order, especially when the specific topic is China's impact, because the concepts can be hard to pin down. And I think it's also hard to know when an order is actually doing something and having an impact. As I say in the episode, maybe it's easier to observe the effect of order more when the order is breached than when it's actually working properly. It was a lot of fun grappling with these questions, and Amy was the perfect guest. But even by the end, it was hard to avoid the feeling that we'd still barely scratched the surface of this immense topic. Nevertheless, we have to start somewhere, and, dear listeners, I'll foreshadow now that I'm going to walk through the model presented in my paper, and Amy will do the same with her disagreements. As with all models, it will be for each of you to decide whether it is useful. And with that, here is my conversation with Amy King. Amy King, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Darren. It's great to be with you.
Well, as you might have heard in a couple of recent episodes I've recorded on international order, my starting point has been this remarkable quote from Secretary Blinken, the US Secretary of State, last year, something to the words of, "We're not witnessing a test of the post-Cold War order, but the end of it." And so I want to start with that quote by asking you, firstly, what do you mean when you think of order, or how do you conceptualize order? And should we use the concept of the post-Cold War order as the most useful starting point for a discussion of China and its influence on the order?
Thanks, Aaron. Well, I mean, it's really good to unpack these terms, right? Because they're these nebulous terms, and there's a lot of language that gets bandied about in this area. So it's helpful, I think, to be really precise about what we're talking about. When I think about order, I'm thinking, I don't want to get too academic here, but essentially thinking about these sort of shared rules, norms, institutions, practices, the things that collectively groups of states, for the purposes of what we're talking about today, choose to participate in. And that might be hierarchical, it might be unequal, we might not all agree on everything, but on certain things we come to some kind of consensus. In terms of the post-Cold War order, I think this is actually a really difficult thing to pin down, because when I think about the current order that we live in, and we can get to whether it's ending or transitioning in a moment, but when I think about the post-Cold War order, I actually think we're talking about an order that has elements of much older periods coexisting with some things that actually emerged in the post-Cold War period. And in particular, I think we're talking about things that emerged in the late stages of World War II, ideas around respect for state sovereignty, non-interference in international affairs, the big institutions like the United Nations, the Bretton Woods system, these kinds of aspects of what we often think of as a pluralist international order, by which we basically are talking about the ways in which states came together, said, we're not going to do empire anymore. The imperial orders of the past are at an end. Instead, we're going to have this kind of sovereign equality-based international order. We don't all look the same. We have diverse values, different political systems, but we respect one another's sort of sovereign equality in this new order. And a lot of that still exists, of course. We still have key elements of that. And that has evolved over time. But I think the big transition that occurs at the end of the post-Cold War period is kind of the emergence of what academics sometimes refer to as the sort of emergence of a solidarist order. It moves in a much more liberal direction, in large part because we have the collapse of the Soviet Union. And so for the first sort of 4 or 5 decades of the Cold War, the Soviet Union, the Soviet bloc, was really a big check on all of the kind of the ideas, principles, rules, norms that the West wanted to entrench in this order. They simply couldn't do those things. But then you have the collapse of the Soviet Union. And in the 1990s and 2000s, we see this order really moving in the direction of much greater focus on sort of principles of good governance, of democracy, liberalism, human rights, respect for humanitarian intervention as a sort of a key pillar of international order. A greater focus, I guess, on the sovereignty and security of individuals rather than the sovereignty and security of states. So that's the big post-Cold War shift. But those two things coexist. So we have this hybrid order today, right? And that's where I think it gets complicated, because we'll get to China, I suppose, at some point. But what China and a whole host of other countries think about when they're thinking about order encompasses all of that.
Yeah, let me add my perspective on this. And I was sort of trying to answer this question through the lens of an Australian diplomat who is out there in the region talking to our partners maybe in Southeast Asia or in the Pacific, and trying to sort of proselytize, maybe is the right verb, the virtues of order. And they get this sort of blank response saying, but what are you talking about? And what I then, so my response to that is to think of order as ultimately something that influences behavior. Right, we are interested in how states behave, what they do at home, as well as what they do abroad. And there are many factors. Podcast listeners will know how much I focus on domestic politics, for example, as a factor in driving states' policy. Order is a label we can use, or a concept to group together a bunch of other factors that, when the rubber hits the road, actually constrain what states do or enable other types of behavior. And maybe it is a concept that is actually more easy to observe in the breach. And we're recording this in mid-April, and there's this wild story from the last week of Ecuadorian law enforcement authorities marching into the Mexican embassy in Quito and arresting a former vice president who had claimed asylum from the Mexicans and had been staying in the embassy. But they're arresting this guy. He's a political opponent of the current leader on corruption charges. And the Mexicans have lost their minds, right? Understandably, like, it is one of the most inviolable principles of international law that you don't get to walk into another country's embassy and just take people. That is a constraint. Like, most governments don't violate that most of the time, almost all of the time. Now, why don't they? And this is where we get to sort of some of the answers that you gave. One of the reasons are that we have rules that say you shouldn't do that. We also have an accumulated body of past behavior that states don't do that. And we have, therefore, kind of the expectation that that won't get done in the future. And both the rules, the past behaviors, and the expectations, I think we give the label order as a way of kind of describing something that is operative on the policy choices of states.
And that's what I think of when I think of what order is. And then I basically agree with you about the post-Cold War order. I would just simply add that it is a combination of rules and institutions and shared understandings that have gone all the way back to World War II, as well as sort of the changing balance of power in the post-Cold War phase, which I think sort of both of them are operative. Order is created not just by rules and institutions and shared understandings, it also is sustained by power, because I think the actions of the most powerful states help create those expectations about what is, you know, going to happen. For example, US hegemony, US power, has shaped Australian security policy. It's also shaped Indonesian security policy and Chinese security policy and Russian security policy and everyone else's, because there's been an expectation about what the US could do and what the US would do in given circumstances. And that over time creates this sort of centrifugal force or gravity that I think shapes states' behavior. I'll let you react to that, but the follow-up question then, and you sort of touched on this, that we needed to go here, is do you agree with Blinken? Have we seen the end of whatever this post-Cold War order was?
Yeah, well, let me first react, because I think the Ecuador example that you give is such an illuminating one, right? And I really agree with your point that order is, it's not only the rules, but it's how we behave and that past behavior and the expectations that creates. And that we do often observe order most obviously in its breach. And I think you're quite right to point to the role of power, because what will be fascinating, I think, with the response to the Ecuador case is how do great powers who ostensibly hold up this order respond to that? Do they come out and do or say things in response to this breach of some of those fundamental core principles of the post-World War II international order? So that will be a key element, I guess, in thinking about, well, how powerful is this order? Does it continue to have any weight at all in constraining state behaviour? In terms of Blinken's question, when I think about order and change, ends of orders, beginnings of new ones, I think we have a tendency in a lot of the literature in our fields to think about big punctuated moments of change, big wars leading to blank slates and creations of new order. But actually, most of the time, it's much more gradual, it's much messier, it's much more transitional, cumulative. We can go back, obviously, to 1945 and more of a blank slate, certainly not a complete one, but a more punctuated moment. But actually, I think it's more helpful to look at the much greater body of evidence at moments of transition over the last 70 or 80 years since then. And to think about the fact that we're probably in one of those moments of transition now. They don't have to be violent. They may be, but they don't have to be. They can involve the just changes in the day-to-day practice of the order's participants, changes in the rules gradually over time. I think about in our region, for instance, the rise of Japan in the 60s and 70s. That led to some pretty major changes in the international order, certainly in this region. Japan pushing for greater status and say in some of the order's key institutions, often resisted by the most powerful in that. The creation of things like the Asian Development Bank, for instance, and big shifts in this region after sort of turning points like the Asian financial crisis and the creation of a whole new set of rules and institutions and practices to respond to new challenges. So I think this moment is a more dramatic one than those past evolutions. But I don't think I would say we're talking about a blank slate. I think whatever comes next is going to evolve gradually. It's going to have to be layered on top of whatever currently exists. We're not seeing any state really tearing up the rule book completely and starting anew.
Yeah, I think I sort of have two reactions to that. I think one is that there obviously the order is weakening, and that is giving us the transition phase that you're describing. And it's weakening because its main pillars are cracking. The balance of power is changing. The US is relatively weaker. China and the global south are relatively more powerful. It is seeing more and more breaches, so those rules and institutions are being ignored or disregarded more often by more consequential players. Think Russia invading Ukraine. There's a pretty strong argument for Israel in Gaza, not to mention Gaza and Israel as a result. And of course, you've got intellectual critiques of that order the global financial crisis and its consequences, the rise of national security in economics, geoeconomics, my field, and of course climate change, right? The need to adapt in order to respond to the climate emergency. So you've got a weakening, and then you've also got a loss of political support. Your political legitimacy of that order, whether inside the global south, who have critiques that they didn't write or have much of a say in its foundation, that's the critique anyway, and you've got obviously the critique from within the west that it's no longer serving the interests of the middle class, the working class, this is nationalism and Trumpism. And I think the final thing is to say about the weakening of this order is that it did have, under US hegemony, a liberal bias to it. Markets got promoted by the Washington Consensus. Democracy got promoted largely by US foreign policy, but also enabled, I think, by some of the big institutions. And we are seeing a move towards the state in economic policy, and we are seeing democratic backsliding. But having said all that, there are all these bits of the order that haven't changed that much. The basic constitutive elements of the order, that we have states and sovereignty, not changing that much. The architecture of the UN system, not changing that much. A lot of international law. Until this week, diplomatic conventions were, diplomatic inviolability was one of that aspects, but like a lot of international law is still being complied with on a daily basis. The financial system is still going strong. The trade system, yes, it's weakening, but it's still being complied with a lot of the time. So I don't fully agree with Blinken, but I think that transition, we're entering that phase, and that's without a doubt. Do you have any reactions to that before we actually get onto China?
Yeah, I guess just two quick ones. One is to say, I mean, I think, again, returning to this idea of power changing, that post-Cold War order often was described as the universal one, but it wasn't, right? It didn't appeal to much of the world, to large swathes of the world. That's not to say that they were completely outside its creation, but I think it's inevitable that we're going to see more pushing at the shape of this order, the content of this order, by the Global South or others who haven't had as much of a hand in its creation. And to be honest, from a normative standpoint, I don't think that's a bad thing. If it's a more equitable order, a more just order for large parts of the developing world. I think the second thing to say is that I find it very helpful to think about international order in its constituent parts. And you alluded to the fact that there are lots of parts of the order that haven't changed. Rather than thinking about international order as sort of one single lumpen rule book somewhere out there, which just doesn't exist, it's actually more helpful, I think, to drill down into the different elements of order, whether we look at that regionally, for instance, or whether we look at that in terms of issue area. And I think we see actually that certain elements of that order are actually much more viable. We can look at an emerging development order or an economic order, a financial order, a human rights order, a nuclear order. And actually we can be, I think, a lot more precise when we drill down into those elements to take a check on the health of those elements and who's shaping them, how contested they are, kind of where the weakening areas perhaps are.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point, and it's a good guide for our diplomats who are looking to build support for that order. The way you would engage with foreign counterparts is to say, here is an element of that order that's in your interests. You might not have labeled it as order, but actually, here are the sources in treaties, here are the sources in practices, and so forth. And the result has been states behaving in ways that are in your interest, but maybe now they're under threat for these reasons, X, Y, and Z, and this is therefore why you should care about order, rather than just simply saying we have these rules-based order and it's good because it's good. Anyway, let's get to China, the main topic. And as I foreshadowed in my introduction, we're going to structure this conversation around a paper that I wrote with my old PhD supervisor, John Arkenberry, and you responded to in the same journal, Security Studies, a little while later. The question here is, what does an order with China as the hegemon, a China-led order, look like? We often hear from commentators, from political leaders, that China is posing a major challenge to the order. And so we wanted to get to the heart of that. What does that actually mean in practice? And it's actually a very difficult question to answer for two reasons. One, as you said earlier, Amy, China doesn't have a blank slate to work with, unlike the US after World War II, where it could really build institutions from the ground up, and as the only sort of powerful state that was left standing in many ways. And the second reason is China's leaders are notoriously vague about their positive vision. One of the China watchers we cited in the article, Nadej Roland, uses this formulation of cryptic and vague formulations, right, as the quote for describing how they talk about order. They're quite clear in what they don't want, but when they say what they do want, it's mostly motherhood statements that are impossible to object to, right? A community of shared future, right? Win-win cooperation. And it's sort of, it's a slippery thing for, I think, Australian policymakers and indeed Western policymakers more generally to deal with, because it's very obvious what the flaws in the current order are. And for every critique of what China might be doing, there's an equivalent critique that the US has done for decades, probably, to make the current order look much less appealing. And so when you have this very vague vision of what might lie just over the horizon in a China-led order, with no meat to really on the bones to engage with and the pros and cons of such an order, it's a very difficult sort of asymmetric task for those who want to defend, in some sense, the status quo. So our goal was to build a model, my favorite pastime, really. And that model had three starting assumptions. One, China wants what all rising powers have always wanted, which is greater control over its external environment, more power, more prestige. With one wrinkle, one perhaps exception to past great powers, which is the goal of regime preservation, that sort of maintaining the particular domestic political configuration, which is one party rule by the CCP, is sort of a key interest that is not one that has been shared as precisely. Yes, the US wanted to make a world safer democracy, in Woodrow Wilson's words, but not a particular configuration the way that the Chinese government does. So that's the first assumption. The second is that to answer the question about what a China-led order might look like, it's quite useful to look inside of China, to their domestic system, to their model of political order and their model of economic organization at home, and that once we have identified those, we can extrapolate to some extent and paint a picture of what a China-led order might look like. And three, we do actually have evidence. We have things that China's leaders have said, and we have a lot of Chinese behavior in its foreign policy over the past 15, 20 years that can also inform what is still ultimately a theoretical model. So we start with that. And then sort of in the first part of the substantive part of the paper, we then look inside China and say, what are the most relevant features for thinking about how China would build order internationally? And you can break those up into political features and economic features. The political feature, of course, is the one-party state guided by Marxist-Leninist principles. But in a more abstract sense, we are talking about a strong state that has got a kind of authoritarian bargain with its people. It is dominated by the party. Yes, there is quite a lot of repression and there's no pluralism at all. But in return, the people get economic benefits. They get economic prosperity. They get a type of social stability. They get a lot of national pride, right, in the rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. So it's not that the Chinese government has no accountability at all. There is a kind of bargain there. It has to provide something to its people in return for having a strong state. That's the political half. And then the economic half, you could summarize in the phrase state capitalism, that yes, we will allow market forces to flourish somewhat, but we reserve the right as a state to intervene heavily on occasion, especially in strategic industries. And therefore, the kind of the broader principles of open markets and free trade that might have permeated the current order don't apply nearly as much in this domestic model. There are many more exceptions. There's a much larger role for the state. So I'll stop there and sort of turn to you for your first response. And I'll frame it simply as, when you are thinking about how China is affecting the international order and will in the future, to what extent do you find it useful to look at China's domestic practices and its domestic structures to inform that analysis and those predictions into the future?
Yeah, thanks, Darren. And I just want to say more generally how terrific it was to have this opportunity to read really closely your paper with John. And instinctively, I thought, no, I disagree here. But you actually have to then take the time and work out, well, why do I disagree? And that's such a useful exercise. So it's great to have this opportunity to sort of to hash some of this out. I think our approach to this question is shaped somewhat by kind of different academic training and the way we come at these sort of questions and whether we're looking at China or any other country's sort of role in international affairs. And I know your penchant for developing models is one that I've heard you talk about a lot on the podcast in the past. That's probably not the approach I tend to take with my work. And while I certainly agree that a country's domestic politics, economics, ways of doing things are very important, I would be more cautious about sort of trying to hypothesize or extrapolate from some kind of ideal model, in part because I think it's quite a limited place to start, and I'll explain why in a moment. But I also think we have actually so much evidence of how China operates and behaves in relation to different elements of international order that we can actually look to that for that evidence rather than having to sort of hypothesize from a domestic model. Let me talk through those two points in turn. And I should also point readers to a terrific critique of the paper as well by Matthew Stephen, who I thought expressed some of these points as well very well. So if people are interested, check out his piece as well. Thinking about China's domestic political economic model, this Leninist state capitalist model, is an interesting place to start. And I was struck, obviously, thinking about China as I do both today, but also during the Mao period, really the height of China's kind of Leninist political model, a time when there was a tendency, I think, from a lot of scholars to use political ideology with a capital I to really explain a lot of China's behavior on the international stage. When we look at China during the Mao period, there is this tendency to think about this Leninist domestic political model or sort of capital I ideology as a bit of a shorthand to explain China's international behavior. But actually, when I looked at China's relationship with Japan, for instance, and went back into the archives to look at official documents and memoirs and kind of newspapers of how China was thinking about and developing policy towards Japan, I realized pretty quickly that this kind of Soviet-influenced political and economic model actually only explained a really small part of China's relationship. And instead, what I found in looking at that sort of bilateral relationship and China's sort of international behavior more generally at this point is that China was shaped by a much wider set of ideas. Questions about, in the case of Japan, what does it mean to be a modern Asian state? What could China learn from Japan's path to power, both positive and negative? What are some of the industrial and technological drivers of national security, and how could China actually absorb some of that from Japan? What kind of threat did Japan pose to China? And it was this set of much wider ideas that only very tangentially related to this sort of Leninist political economic model that explained actually why we saw China pursue such a strong economic relationship with Japan at a time when it actually made very little sense from a sort of a political economic standpoint. These are two countries that don't share political ideologies, that are on opposite sides of a Cold War divide, have no diplomatic relationship, had just ended a major war. And yet for the variety of Chinese kind of ideas about Japan that I've just explained, they saw a relationship with Japan as really crucial to China's own future. And so I think we can and must examine kind of the breadth of China's foreign policy ideas and behavior in any specific situation or context or policy area, and think about the range of factors, whether that's the domestic context, China's own history, the response of other countries, kind of the international normative environment, balance of power, a whole host of factors that shape its behavior in those precise contexts. And I think they're really open-ended empirical questions that I find it too dangerous to just assume from sort of an extrapolated domestic model. And I think there's a whole host of scholarship looking at China's behavior in a whole variety of international order issue areas that we can actually point to. So coming back to this idea of the domestic political economic model, I was quite struck, I guess, in looking at Australian discourse on China over the last decade or so, about how, particularly after Xi Jinping came to power, and I think probably around the time of sort of the Malcolm Turnbull government here in Australia, there was a lot of talk from policy commentators and from some academics as well about this Leninist country and how it was going to behave on the world stage. And a lot of that sort of ended up in the direction of talk about China's influence operations and things like that. But I do find it quite a narrow way of thinking about China's international behavior. It may say something about China's domestic behavior, but I think internationally, we need to draw in this whole range of other factors, including how other countries are responding to China and the much wider set of kind of international normative influences on China that are shaping how it actually behaves in the world.
One of the sections of our paper, actually the second section after the introduction, is focused on the United States. And we make the argument that you need to understand the US's domestic political and economic model in at the time of the order's creation in the post-war era and its evolution over the decades that followed to help inform major features of that order that ultimately resulted. And obviously, we're probably just sort of this splitting hairs in where we want to locate our starting point and how much weight we apply to these different factors. But we do argue in the piece that there is a bias towards free markets and there is a bias towards democracy that comes from those domestic foundations that does shape the order. Now, that doesn't mean the US doesn't behave like a selfish, power-hungry hegemon a lot of the time, as all hegemons would do. But at the margins, maybe even more than at the margins and in the substantive structures that emerge, you do see liberal features. And John, of course, is famous for sort of being the main theorist of the liberal international order. And he kind of locates those features in the way in which the US chooses to organise matters at home. I mean, stepping away from China, I mean, would you accept that on the US case? And how are you informed by the formation of that post-war order and the US's leadership of it when you think about China and how it might lead an alternative?
Yeah, I think my approach to orders would start at a different place because I think of orders as fundamentally shared phenomena, collective phenomena. So I'm less interested in what are the kind of preferences, practices, domestic character, if you like, of the hegemon atop that order. I'm more interested in what do the countries involved in shaping that order collectively define as its content, as its goals, as its purpose, right? Yes, that hegemon matters, absolutely. I mean, there's no denying that US ideas, US material power played a fundamentally important role in convening the creation of that order and in bringing countries together. But if we look at the creation of the post-World War II order for a moment and the economic elements of that, which are the ones that I particularly focus on, what I'm often struck by when I look back at just even the Western side of that story is how collective and contested it was, even just between the US and the British. Two countries who agreed on many, many, many things, right? Mm. Genuinely pretty politically aligned, but had enormous disagreements, huge contestation, and actually couldn't reach consensus on some certain key elements because they thought about what it meant to be liberal in quite different ways. They thought about protectionism and tariffs and quotas in quite different ways. And they disagreed on just how powerful, for instance, the US should be. But fundamentally, that post-World War II economic order was forged through a consensus between not only what the US wanted, but also what other industrialized countries, particularly in Europe, really wanted. And that was about how to preserve a domestic order through things like social welfare that would actually prevent kind of wild fluctuations in international markets, harming countries at home as they had during the 1920s and 30s. The other key piece of this story, though, that has been for so long often overlooked by scholars thinking about the post-World War II order is the role of non-liberal, illiberal, however you want to call them, countries that didn't look like the US, the British, the European powers, countries like in Asia, in Africa, in Latin America, developing countries, post-colonial countries, non-industrialized countries, who actually played a really formative role in shaping some of the key elements of the post-World War II order, whether on human rights, in terms of ideas about sovereign equality, the right to self-determination, the ideas around development. There's increasingly literature pointing to the work that these countries did, not just in kind of endorsing US ideas about what that order should look like, but actually coming up with those ideas in the first place. And China...
And the result being an order that wasn't the US's That's ideal, right? I'm assuming it's pulling it away from that liberal democratic ideal into something...
Exactly. Yeah. And look, I think it's important. It actually happened on America's watch because a lot of these countries, and China is the key example I focus on, they could actually kind of use US discourse for their own ends, right? They could talk about the fact that they could sort of harness US discourse about equality, about opposition to empire, and say, well, if you really agree with those things, maybe you should actually be thinking about human rights and development for post-colonial and war-torn countries. And that's what we see countries like China, India, countries in Latin America doing really actively, shaping that order, harnessing kind of US power to get their own ideas into the mix. So I do think that the order is a lot more collective and that it didn't only have these liberal roots. And actually that leads me as a result to be a lot more optimistic that we can actually reach some kind of order transition in this current moment that actually might have buy-in from other countries, and it doesn't necessarily require that liberal starting point just because of a liberal hegemon.
Okay, well let me then move then to sort of the meat of our argument. And again, to stress, we're building a model here. We're not sort of making an empirical prediction. But I do, to the extent that our paper had virtues or has virtues, I'd like to think that one of them was just we're quite clear in what we think, where we're coming from and where we want to go with it to enable disagreements, right? A disagreement is healthy. I think it helps move our thinking forward. So we say that take these three assumptions about China being in many ways a normal rising power but wanting regime preservation. Second, that their domestic practices are relevant. And third, we also bring in their observed behaviour. We come up with three logics, as we call them, for an ideal type China-led order. The first is called the logic of difference, and it is a version of what we have today, just a much stronger version, and that is one where the international system is defined by sovereignty, right? States are not constrained nearly as much as they are today by international rules and institutions in what they do at home. Now, the goal here, of course, is to protect China's model. This is why it works for China. But what that translates into is a much greater deal of indifference into what happens around the world. As long as China's own interests are respected, and indeed they would say that is a founding principle, that you're going to have strong sovereignty, but you have to be respectful of other countries' interests. Now, what that means, we can come to it in a minute. So it's not that big a departure. Indeed, if you read the UN Charter, it's sort of what you would read in those first few articles, right? Sovereignty is supposed to be the foundation, states are the major player. That in practice, what we're saying is it is much stronger than what the way the liberal international order, including the post-war, post-Cold War order, evolved. That's the logic of difference. The second is called the logic of win-win. Win-win is a phrase that is often used by China's leaders, and that is really trying to define the pitch that the Chinese are making to the world as to why you should follow us, why you should work with us and allow us to be the leader. And that is the functional benefits that being part of our system would give to you. And that is focused very much on the logic of economic development, right? Everything is about becoming developed, becoming prosperous. And through economic development will come security, right? We are going to wash away all disagreements because we're all getting rich together. And the kind of practices are led by Belt and Road Initiative and other bilateral engagements with countries rather than through these large multilateral institutions. But importantly, we're all winning. It's win-win. It's good for you. It's good for us because we all care about development first and foremost. And then the third one we call the logic of partnerships, and partnerships is the term that's been used by China's leaders. And again, it really is a follow-on from the logic of difference, which is that states don't interact through institutions and through rules nearly as much. And they don't work multilaterally nearly as much. Much more of the problem solving and the interactions are done informally through personalistic bilateral relationships, often driven by leaders who have been in charge maybe for quite a long time. These things are worked out amongst leaders. There's much less of a role for civil society, for not just international institutions, but civil society actors. States are really dominating, and that's part of the logic of difference as well, and that the things are resolved informally, ad hoc, and bilaterally, rather than through some large system of institutions. Now, they're the three pillars, and we make the point at that point of the paper that they're not inherently illiberal. Right, like if you think of the liberalism as being about free markets and about sort of open political systems, none of those is inherently biased towards an illiberal model. But the key part of the argument is that the practice of an order led like that will have illiberal features or illiberal gravitational forces to it. And there are two reasons for that. The first reason is that win-win is just not possible to do forever. Development is hard, and the middle income trap, which is a barrier to countries becoming wealthy, is real. China struggles with it, not just China, all of the developed world. And so the idea that we can ride off into the sunset and continuously pursue economic development together is not realistic. And so the only way the logic of win-win can work, where you are kind of wash awaying a lot of political and other disagreements through development, is if you have narrowed political spaces inside those recipient countries. It's not the whole country that is winning. It is a narrowed slice, probably an elite that is then able to use repression and patronage from the Chinese hegemon in order to sustain its political legitimacy and its political control. And so there's going to be more repression. There's going to be a bit of a bias or gravitational force that pushes countries towards less liberal political models at home in order to sustain the logic of win-win as a basis of engaging with China. So that's not a deliberate strategy. We're not saying you need to assume that Chinese are trying to seed authoritarianism. We're saying that the way win-win works, it's just going to push things in that direction. The second reason is the complete absence of any mechanisms of dispute resolution in this. The logic of partnerships, the logic of win-win, and the logic of difference are all like, well, we'll take into account each other's interests. We won't let institutions and rules guide us and constrain us. We'll just work things out. But if you don't have any mechanisms of oversight and of dispute resolution, like we do have in the UN and in the WTO, ultimately that means that power is going to play a much larger role. Not that it didn't play a role in the US under US leadership, but under a Chinese-led order in this model, power, especially in the bilateral context, is going to be a much larger factor in resolving these conflicts of interest, which will inevitably arise. And it's very noticeable that the Chinese leadership has had almost nothing to say about what dispute resolution would look like in a world where they want much more influence. So that's sort of the argument, that there are these three guiding principles. One about strength and sovereignty, one about economic development as the lodestone of all engagement, and one about informal state-led mechanisms of working together. It's the logic of partnerships. And that when you take those three principles, you get a bias towards illiberal political models at home, and you get a bias towards power or illiberal political models of dispute resolution abroad. That's the argument. Amy, you and Matthew Stephen wrote responses to that. So I'll let you come at that any way you want to in formulating your response.
Thanks, Darren. And look, I think it's really helpful to tease out those three logics because I found myself agreeing with certain elements of them, disagreeing with some others. And so kind of ended up in a slightly different direction, I suppose. Not a completely different direction. And I think my response will show that in some ways I do disagree with you, but I do still think there are some real blind spots in China's kind of vision for what it wants the future of international order to look like. And it's important to pay attention to those because that's where the real dangers lie, I suppose. So, you know, if I start from that kind of, okay, collective starting point of China's future vision for international order based on the evidence that we have of its past behaviour. I think I agree with your sense of this logic of difference. Yes, there is very clear evidence that China champions these principles of sovereign equality, respect for borders. That's been at the heart of kind of China's thinking. Really, we can go back quite a long way, but certainly since 1945, 1949, etc. And I think I would call this championing of this pluralist international order because that, as you said, the UN Charter fundamentally preserves those things. It recognises that states have sovereignty over what happens within those borders. And China has been less comfortable with perhaps where that has ended up with things like the responsibility to protect, although not exclusively. But it sees the UN system, for instance, as a really, I guess, as the most realistic way for countries to achieve relatively peaceful coexistence if they don't agree on a whole host of other things, if they're not all liberal, if they don't have the same political systems, if they have different histories and different interests in the world. And so we've actually seen China very, very supportive and actively involved in the UN system. It was one of the founding members, of course. It has that veto right, so it appeals to China in that respect, of course. But it funds the UN in very important ways. It staffs the UN very actively, very important in peacekeeping and many of the other UN institutions, and point to the work of people like Rosemary Foote, Courtney Fung and others who've really established that. And I think there I would disagree a bit on your point about China doesn't do things multilaterally, because actually we do see China very, very actively involved in UN institutions, in the World Trade Organization, in its dispute resolution processes and all the rest. It wants to preserve that system. And so I think the logic of difference for me means it's not just that China is trying to kind of to tear up the existing order, but rather it's trying to preserve that key element of that order. And it's something that China is very aligned with a whole host of other countries on, the Global South in particular, countries, many, many countries that were fairly new to their own sovereignty, post-colonial countries. They similarly share this idea of support for sovereign equality, the UN as an institution in which they all have an equal stake. So China is actually pretty aligned with other countries there. On this logic of difference, I think, so while China does have very clear support for kind of UN institutions, I think its overwhelming support for this logic of difference, as you call it, or this sort of these pluralist ideas, as I've called it, does actually lead to some important blind spots for China. Because I think although China has been very active in bolstering the UN system and wanting to strengthen its own power within that system, as we would expect any rising country to do, I think it's also worked with, for instance, Russia in particular, to kind of move the UN system closer to its own preferences and to really reinforce the sense in that system that there's no consensus on a whole lot of issues. China is not the spoiler that Russia is. It has actually come a long way on a lot of these questions. But I think this absolute kind of preference for respect for difference, as you say, and sovereign equality does mean that China doesn't have a lot to show in terms of how to think about and resolve collective problems beyond the borders of the nation state. So that's where we really sort of need to see more from China. And I don't think China only wants to do things bilaterally, but we certainly do see a preference for, you know, whether it's the Belt and Road Initiative or in the South China Sea, wanting to work more bilaterally to resolve differences, challenges, problems. But it means that when you do think about these big, complex, global scale challenges, China has less of its own initiative to draw on in how to resolve those at sort of at the collective level. So certainly a blind spot for China.
Let me come in quickly and respond. I mean, I agree that China absolutely does a lot of work multilaterally at the moment. And of course, our paper is sort of trying to project this hypothetical future. And the where I struggle sort of to reconcile the observed practice of their multilateralism in reality versus how I think about building a model of order is the distinction, I guess, between their near abroad and over there, right? They're quite happy to use these mechanisms of organising political affairs and even resolving disputes when they are issues that are far from their borders and where they don't really need to take a leadership role. They can support, but they're not interested in playing that role and having skin in the game. And I think of how they've really been a backseat player in the conflict in the Middle East in the last 6 months as an example of that. But of course, when you get to their core interests, which are expanding as they become more powerful, they have zero interest in turning to these larger international institutions to structure how those conflicts get resolved. And so this is where the extrapolation is really playing its role here. We're imagining, again, a hypothetical, theoretical future where those interests are truly global. And it becomes just not in China's interests to really use these institutions much at all. Now, we'll never get to that point. That is really a hypothetical. But we're trying to kind of isolate those instincts within China, the Chinese policymaking mind about the legitimacy of engaging and indeed submitting, like you're ultimately submitting your sovereignty to a larger process for the greater good. At some level, the US, albeit with lots of hypocrisy along the way, built a system where the part of the point of it was you are going to erode the sovereign protections of the state, because it is in everyone's interest to do so. It is a solution to a collective action problem. We all have to give up a little bit, give up a bit of our freedom of action. And in fact, in many ways, quite a lot. And we do that because that is the way we solve these global problems. And you agree that China hasn't got a lot to say and about many of these global problems. It's a blind spot for them. And so as a theorist, I'm saying, okay, because the part of the reason for that is because they're not recognizing the need that for walking back the absolutism of sovereignty in order to get traction on those. Would you be sympathetic to that
I think argument? I would be, in the sense that I think there is a gap between what China can do currently and the need, the global need for resolution of these very complex problems. And that gap means, and if we can, we think about orders as collective things that everyone wants to participate in for a reason, I think it means that there will continue to be limits on how much other countries are willing to support a more Chinese-led international order. And it's why you see ongoing demand in many parts of the world for preservation of the United States' role and other major powers' role in leading this order, because that gap hasn't yet been filled by others, whether China or anyone else. And so I think that goes a long way to explaining why in Australia, in our own region here in Asia, the demand for that US leadership and role is still there, because that need for that collective problem solving is absolutely still there. Can I come back to one of your other logics? And that's this logic of win-win. Because I think, yes, I very much agree that development and economic development in particular has been at the heart of how China for a long time, but in particular under Xi Jinping, has approached its relationships with other countries. Development has been really, it's not only how he thinks about China domestically, but it's how it's his operating logic for China's place in the world. And it drives so much of China's relations with the Global South, the Belt and Road Initiative, of course, and everything else. Now, yes, there are obviously interests to bear here and economic side payments that other countries get. They can do well out of kind of Chinese largesse. But actually, one of the reasons why I think China's vision, if you like, for international order and this sort of development-centered order is so powerful is because it aligns with how other countries already think about kind of the main problem, their main challenge in international life, or domestic life, that is, that for that matter. And it's development, whether we're talking about here in our own region or among the Global South more generally. This idea of development as being at the heart of regime security, of national security, is one that's very common to many of these countries. They need to develop first before they can resolve all the other sort of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? And so China is speaking their language. They don't have to try and buy these countries. They're already aligned. Now, again, I think that's a good thing in some respects. The international order has ignored the development needs of many countries for far too long, and it really got subsumed during the Cold War, unfortunately. And so it's good to see more voice and attention paid and simple financial kind of investment in this great need for development. But again, I do agree with you that there are limits here to China's vision. And because it thinks of the world largely through this state-based kind of model, it doesn't think about the voices of civil societies in these recipient countries and whether development actually works for all, as you say. So I do agree with you there. And I think what I'm interested in looking at and focusing on is, to what extent does China tolerate resistance and compromise and challenge from below? Would a Chinese-led order actually invite such collaboration and resistance? Because an order, if I'm right and I think it's a collective thing, has to involve the participation of all. And how the hegemon or great power responds to that is really important and key to whether the other members of that order actually see it as legitimate and want to participate. So I think that's going to be a really key thing to watch. And I think sort of in the development space, China is absolutely learning. It's learning from its own mistakes. It's learning that it needs to actually adapt things like the Belt and Road Initiative, but it is still too quick to focus only on kind of the regime in power, the voices of the state, and much less kind of willing to adapt its practices in response to critiques from civil society groups, for instance.
Yeah, it's a question of sort of institutional capacity for me. I mean, hidden, I think, in the, or at least motivating me in writing the paper with John, was the observation that the big sort of quote-unquote failures or controversies of Belt and Road stem ultimately from a lack of transparency, a lack of accountability in the recipient countries. And so higher standards, not other solution, rather than to try to cancel China's economic engagement. And that means you need to care about political institutions, you need to care about sort of some of the governance effects, right? You want to worry about corruption, you want to worry about rising authoritarianism, not because you have a commitment to liberal political principles, but because they matter for development, right? And dictators tend to make bad economic policy choices. They tend to, they're more likely than your average politician or average human being to probably be a bit corrupt and look to enrich themselves because they have the ability to do so. And so hidden in the paper is this message to sort of, I guess, Western policymakers that the pitch has to not be, you can't say development is bad. We hear you, and you're absolutely right, Amy, to say that this is a vision that is very appealing to the developing world, but it has to be constrained by sort of institutional safeguards at the domestic level. And China has shown very little regard for those. I would agree that they're adjusting a bit, right, in the last few years, and there's sort of an emphasis on high quality projects, I think, to use Xi Jinping's language. But by and large, that's the major risk here, right? So the ideal type model is just that, it's an ideal type hypothetical, but there is a concrete policy issue here that I think we're trying to offer a pathway to how you engage with the region on those questions.
I completely agree with the call to action to focus more on the recipient country side of all of these equations, because what they do and how they respond matters. And whether we're talking about Chinese policymakers or Australian ones, we often forget that side of the story. And that's absolutely going to be crucial in thinking about not only questions of development, but how the order evolves more generally. The second point I think I'd say is that we need to be careful not to to always slip back into the kind of liberal, using scare quotes there, principles driving development. I mean, there are some good reasons why Western IMF, etc. standards, World Bank standards for development haven't always suited or worked particularly well for the recipient countries. And there's a whole realm of critical development studies literature there, which makes the case for the fact that these often haven't actually benefited the recipients, these standards. And actually what China is offering in terms of fast-paced development, a willingness to give finance where perhaps other development banks would not, is actually potentially going to be in the long-term development interests of these countries. Not exclusively, and I don't want to paint too broad brush here, but China is starting from a different historical standing point. It's thinking about it's still a developing country in many respects. It learned about giving development at a time when it was also receiving development. And it knows what benefited China on that path to power. In fact, learned a great deal from Japan and Japan's sort of granting of huge industrial and technological assistance to China in the 60s, 70s and 80s. And so I think we can be a little paternalistic sometimes in telling developing countries what they need. And one of the reasons why China continues to appeal is because it offers some different elements there. Not universally great either, obviously with problems, but I think we need to be a little more historically informed as well as thinking about the recipient side of things.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I've been saying to anyone who will listen, there are two principles that should guide how you talk about these things: transparency and accountability. You should know, people should know what is happening, and when a leader, whether they're democratically elected or an autocrat, makes bad policy choices, they should be able to hold them to account in some way for those bad policy choices, whatever, however you define bad. And they do not have to be liberal values. I wouldn't, exactly, the liberal scare quotes, very apt. I think you can argue for the virtues of those two principles to anyone. There's a lot of space for the Chinese or anyone to act and engage with countries and economically while upholding those two in particular. So that's my attempt to kind of get around it.
Yes, China does, I think, often have a preference for working bilaterally. We shouldn't forget all the work that it does do within a whole host of multilateral institutions. And there's great evidence of China having learned to be much more active in everything from the ASEAN Regional Forum to UN arms control institutions and everything in between. So it does work multilaterally. It's grown in comfort in working multilaterally. But yes, I think as we were talking about before in terms of that gap between China's willingness to work in terms of multilateral institutions, but its ability to sort of think about complex problems beyond the borders of the nation state and perhaps to create new multilateral initiatives to resolve some of those particularly thorny challenges, I think we see room for improvement there would be my judgment.
Well, I mean, look, one of the easy critiques of our paper, which is true, which is we're only telling a fraction of the story because we're not saying anything about how China's preferences, even if we're accurate in characterizing them, and how their actions actually interact with the current order, which is very thick, it's weak in points. Maybe it's ending if we believe Secretary Blinken. But we're happily living in a theoretical world. And so I guess the wrap-up question here is, how are you approaching this question now? China is going to be a force that is shaping the international order into the future. What are you looking at? How are you looking to understand the way and answer that question? Like, what's your approach?
Yeah, well, in some ways it takes us back to where we started. And, you know, if Anthony Blinken is right and we're living at the end of the current order, or at least a very significant transition in it, I'm very interested in understanding earlier moments, other moments of major transition in the international order. And as I perhaps alluded to at the start, I'm thinking a lot about and writing a book, in fact, on China's relationship with the international economic order in the post-war period. And so we know very well that story of how the Great Depression and protectionism and economic rivalries in the 20s and 30s pushed the world into World War II and kind of the significant new thinking that it catalyzed, particularly in the US and Europe, which leads to the creation of the liberal economic order, the Bretton Woods order. What I'm doing is sort of excavating the Chinese side of that story, I suppose, and sort of looking at how did China think about that moment? What were the big drivers of China's desire? It was a very strong desire to participate in the creation of and shaping of that order. And in some ways, trying to disentangle the strategic from the liberal motivations for international economic order, because I think that actually goes a long way to explaining how China thought about it, how it was then excluded from that order during the kind of the Mao years, and trying to understand, I suppose, what of order it wants to preserve and change, the ways in which it has tried to shape the order in the past, and what that leads us to today. But also, I guess, to return to that idea that lots of different kinds of states can play a role in forging partial consensus, and that we don't actually all have to look alike and think alike to create an order. And perhaps channeling Alan here, managing difference is the work of order creation, right? It's the work of our diplomats. And working with non-like-minded countries, in fact, is actually how you create an order. And that's the fundamental part of what we do. So I'm interested in understanding one of those countries in particular, China, at that last moment of order creation. And then thinking about kind of what remains from those older ideas. Today, we hear Xi Jinping talking a lot about self-reliance, about development, about ideas that really have their origins back in the 30s and 40s. Do they still mean the same things? What's changed? How does China see the world today? What of that history resonates in the future?
Well, I want to read you a quote which describes how I'm approaching these questions now and into the future. We must recognize there is a new widespread willingness to make economic interventions on the basis of national interests and national sovereignty. And, critically, none of this is being left solely to market forces or trusted to the invisible hand. The heavy lifting of economic transition and industrial transformation is not being done by individuals, companies, or communities on their own. It is being facilitated, enabled, and empowered by national governments from every point on the political spectrum. That encapsulates sort of what I think is most interesting about this moment.
Do you know who said that? FDR, would I be right?
I think he would love it. It was our own Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, yesterday in Brisbane. We're recording this on the 12th of April.
There again.
And the PM has come up with a manufacturing plan, or that something is coming in the budget. But it, I mean, it speaks to where I am focusing a lot of my research right now, how a government's looking to intervene in markets, depart from the logics that gave us the post-war era, which were logics designed to respond to the beggar-the-neighbour protectionism of the 1920s and 30s. You described this earlier, those wild swings, those political forces that really were quite powerful in giving us the conditions that led to World War II. And governments everywhere now are intervening for legitimate reasons, national security, climate change, looking to pursue development. But the baby could get thrown out with the bathwater here. There is a larger principle that free trade is good and it helps promote not just economic development, but it also can be a force for peace. And how we bound those exceptions that are needed, how governments are managing that is of great interest to me. And in many ways, the most interesting actions are being taken by Western governments right now. China, we kind of know where they stand on these things. And so that's getting a lot of my interest.
Oh, that's great to say. I mean, I have to say, turning back to earlier moments just makes that resonate so much for me, because the role of the state versus the market. I mean, these are big debates that are being, that are happening right around the time of World War II. And it wouldn't surprise me that someone like FDR had said something very, very similar, because lots of countries were talking this talk, right? And yeah, so we'll have to record another podcast on this again.
I'll bet Albo would be chuffed to hear that this was a tribute to FDR. Well, Amy, this has been a fabulous conversation. And as we turn toward home, you knew Alan. I'd like to invite you to share a memory or reflection on him.
Thanks, Darren. And I was very lucky to, early on in my time at the ANU a few years ago, have the chance to travel to China with Alan and to do some work with him on a sort of a joint Australia-China economic project with a number of others. And I think, probably echoing what many others have said, Alan's kindness and generosity to a very junior, shy member of that group, his willingness to listen and encourage was really striking and really inspired me and gave me sort of encouragement to continue doing the work that I do. And I remember talking to him a lot about how academia and the policy world could meet and interact, and often felt, I think this is something you've reflected on in the past, that I didn't have policy relevant work per se, that I didn't have policy solutions to offer to government. And Alan was very, very thoughtful in talking about actually the work that academics do in kind of informing, I guess, the worldview of the policy world, and not coming up to them with solutions, because we do very different things. And I certainly don't want to tell policymakers how to do their jobs, because they know their worlds far better than I could ever. But what I think was so helpful in those discussions with Alan is him being able to tease out what he saw of value and could take away from the work of academics, and how that could inform kind of the work that he was more used to doing in the policy world.
Yeah, that absolutely, of course, resonates with me, because I lived that reality with him in 5+ years on the podcast. He was constantly not just respectful, but actually open and enthusiastic about the perspective that I could bring as an academic to the policy-making questions that he was grappling with. So thank you for that. Well, our final segment is reading, listening, and watching. Do you have a recommendation you'd like to share?
Yeah, I actually just finished reading Richard Flanagan's Question 7, autobiography of his life, his parents' life, set in and amongst Tasmania, Britain in the 19th century, and Japan, actually, around World War II and its aftermath. So it went in lots of different directions that I wasn't expecting. And actually, as someone who's very interested in kind of the legacy of World War II, his thinking and writing about the impact of his father's experience in the war and the development of the bomb and bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki is something that I wasn't expecting to find in that book, but it was really powerful. And his writing about what the past means in the present and how we remember was really pretty captivating. So highly recommend that book.
Thanks, Amy. Well, I am working on a project at the moment which is sort of looking to compare and contrast Australia's approach to the bilateral relationship with China with that of New Zealand. And yeah, our Kiwi friends, often overlooked by Australian commentators and scholars, have a very interesting experience. one that is complex and from which we can learn a lot. And there is one book and that you would turn to first, I think, if you wanted to get a sense of the Kiwi experience. It was published just last year. It's called The China Tightrope, Navigating New Zealand's Relationship with a World Superpower. And the author is Sam Sachdeva, who I believe is a journalist and working in the New Zealand system. And yeah, as a starting point, I'll have more to say on this in written, if not in spoken form, in the months ahead. But if anyone is curious, that is where I would begin. Well, Amy, thank you. This was exactly what I hoped it would be. This is a really important question and component of this question of the future of the international order. And you are the perfect guest. So really, thanks very much for joining me.
Thanks so much, Darren. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Well, that is all for today's episode of Australia in the World. I thank Corbin Duncan for research and audio editing today. And of course, Rory Stedding for composing our theme music. We will talk to you again soon.